Thank you, Craig.
Very good.
Our third speaker is Professor Stephen Calabrese. Professor Calabrese is a graduate of Yale College. Were you POR?
Yale Law School, too.
And yep. POR?
In the POR, yes.
Yes, all right. And Yale Law School. He's a member of the faculty of Northwestern University School of Law. He served as a law clerk to Justice Scalia and also clerk for Judges Bork and Judge Winter from 1985 to 1990. Served in the Reagan and Bush administrations, working both in the White House, before that in the Department of Justice. He also served as a special assistant to Attorney General Ed Meese. 1982, Professor Calabrese co-founded the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies, now a central part of the vast right-wing conspiracy. Professor Calabrese.
Thank you. My topic today is the historical foundations of the rule of law in the American constitutional order. And this is an enormous subject which I can only hope to outline in the brief time I have to speak. I want to begin by discussing the nature of the rule of law and by explaining why it's difficult to speak of an origin of the idea of the rule of law. I will then discuss some of the many antecedent events and cultural patterns which I believe led the framers to seek to preserve the rule of law through our written constitution. First, let's consider the nature of the rule of law. My thesis here is that the rule of law is a cultural or tradition-based norm whereby members of a society come to organize their personal behavior and the behavior of their government officials so that it is law-abiding or law-respecting. A culture which favors the rule of law is one in which millions of individuals choose to behave in a certain way, such that their behavior is governed by law. There are many cultures around the world, and not all of them place a premium on people behaving in a way that is law-abiding. In some cultures, people don't abide by the tax laws, or the laws against corruption, or even some of the criminal laws. In my ancestral homeland of Italy, for example, it's commonly said that there is less of a culture of obeying the tax laws than there is in the United States. Similarly, in Russia or in parts of Eastern Europe or in Latin America, norms against governmental corruption may not be as widely followed as they are in the United States. The key point is that the rule of law is a culture or tradition of behaving in a certain way, not a doctrine that can be legislated. One way of better explaining the nature of the rule of law is to analyze it by using the framework of Friedrich Hayek, who argued that there are two major and distinct forms of social organization in the world: spontaneous systems of order and planned systems of order. A spontaneous system of order is one that grows up unplanned through the voluntary cooperation of millions of people. Classic examples of spontaneous systems of order are languages, or the common law, or the free market. No central planner ever set out to plan a language or a system of common law or a free market, yet those systems spontaneously arose because of the undirected actions of millions of individuals. In contrast, a planned system of order is one where a central planner directs and implements a particular plan. Generals, corporate CEOs, heads of families, and government bureaucrats may all preside over planned systems of order. The rule of law, in my view, is a spontaneous system of order like a language. It cannot be planned or ordered into existence. It has to spring up as a culture from the independent actions and convictions of millions of people acting together in a certain way. There is thus no one single historical origin or originator of the ideal of the rule of law that underlies the U.S. Constitution. Rather, our Constitution arose out of a long-standing culture or tradition that deeply respected the rule of law. Well, if there's no single historical origin or originator of the idea of the rule of law in the American constitutional order, what, if anything, can we say about the origins of our tradition of law abidingness, including by high government officials? Here, there are, I think, many historical antecedents that were important in giving rise to the rule of law in the United States. At the risk of slighting some, I will highlight a few of the antecedents that I believe were especially important. A first important historical antecedent of the rule of law in the United States was the primacy of Roman civil law throughout Western Europe from the Middle Ages on up to 1787. Beginning with the rediscovery of Roman civil law in Bologna, Italy, circa 1100 AD, Roman law, and in particular the Byzantine Emperor Justinian's Code of Roman Civil Law, became the dominant source of private law throughout the areas that would become France, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the rest of Western Europe. This meant that the contract law, property law, tort law, and family law were all governed by Roman law rules throughout Western Europe for a period of some 800 years prior to the writing of the U.S. Constitution. This primacy of Roman law in Western and Central Europe was incredibly important because it meant that the law was independent of the political and religious authorities in Western Europe, and critically, in some sense, superior to them. Roman law, as developed by university professors, was a superior source of authority in private law to either what kings or popes thought the private law should be. Thus, in some ways, kings and popes and other high government and church officials in the West were subordinate to the law. The unity of the Roman common law throughout Western and Central Europe became a feature of the general unity of the West, along with the universal Catholic Church and the universally spoken Latin language. Medieval Europe, in some sense, thus had one law, one church, and one language. Thus, the first source of the American tradition of the rule of law is the primacy of Roman civil law throughout much of Western and Central Europe for a period of 800 years. A second major source of the American tradition of the rule of law is the great unwritten English constitutional tradition dating back to Magna Carta. Americans were British citizens until 1776, and they claimed to possess the ancient rights and liberties of Englishmen. The English legal tradition, in turn, was very oriented towards securing the rule of law, even as against the highest government officials. By 1787, it was well established in English constitutional law that the king himself was subordinate to the law. It's worth rehearsing four key attributes of the unwritten English constitution that caused it by 1787 to guarantee the rule of law. First and most famously, there is Magna Carta, which of course limited English royal power in many important ways. The per legem terris clause of Magna Carta, which has already been talked about, is a direct ancestor of our due process clause and protected individuals against arbitrary and capricious executive action. This alone went a long way toward establishing a culture respectful of the rule of law. Second, there are the early Plantagenet institutions of English law, created between the reigns of William the Conqueror and King Henry VII. These include the creation of the Royal Courts of Justice, the creation of the two representative houses of Parliament, the recognition of a right to trial by jury with conviction requiring unanimity, and all of these institutions help preserve freedom in England and to limit the otherwise arbitrary power of high government officials. A third feature of the English constitutional tradition important to our framers. In the 18th century, the king, the parliament, and the royal courts of justice were all in some sense independent and co-equal powers of government. Montesquieu attributed the flowering of liberty and of the rule of law in England to this celebrated system of separation of powers. Indeed, he predicted that absent such a system of separation of powers, true liberty was impossible. In addition to Roman law and English antecedents of the rule of law in the United States, there's one other important set of antecedents we've not yet discussed. That is the practice in the American colonies and states from 1620 to 1787 of governing themselves according to a rule of law. We often forget that by the time the U.S. Constitution was written, Americans had been governing themselves under law for roughly 180 years. The patterns of behavior and traditions and customs formed during those 180 years were critical in laying the groundwork for the legal tradition that gave rise to our written constitution. One key feature of colonial governance from 1620 to 1787 is that eventually all 13 of the original colonies had a controlling royal charter or constitution. After independence came in 1776, 11 of the 13 newly free states drew up their own written state constitutions and two other states, Connecticut and Rhode Island, continued to function under their royal charters. There was thus, by 1787, a deeply ingrained tradition of written constitutionalism in the United States. This emphasis on written constitutionalism was a distinctively American adaptation of the English constitutional tradition. Other elements of the English constitutional tradition that were present in England but lacking in the United States were the right to life tenured judges and the right not to be taxed without being represented in the taxing legislature. These rights were lacking in America prior to 1776, but the framers' insistence on their importance in the Declaration of Independence made them fundamental rights of Americans by 1787. Between 1776 and 1787, 11 states drafted written constitutions, and the federal government drafted, ratified, and lived under a constitution called the Articles of Confederation. These early American experiments with written constitutionalism were heavily influenced by the spirit of the American Revolution of 1776. These constitutions all had weak executives because of the 1776 experience with King George III. The federal Articles of Confederation created a very weak national government because of the bad 1776 experience with English imperial power. And finally, these documents all provided little protection for liberty or property rights because it was just assumed that having a democratically elected legislature instead of the English king would protect key rights of the people. In the 11 years between 1776 and 1787, the framers discovered that the initial state and federal constitutions they had drafted were not adequate to secure the rule of law. They found that the executive branches they had created were too weak and the legislatures too strong. They found that they had given too much power to the states and not enough to the national government. And finally, they found that democracies need to be bound by a Bill of Rights that protects liberty and property every bit as much as a monarchy needs to be. In short, they discovered that in 1776 they had overreacted and weakened executive and national power too much because of their recent bad experience with the imperial royal government of King George III. This brings us to our third and final topic, which is what did the framers do in designing the U.S. Constitution to secure, anchor, and promote the rule of law tradition they had inherited from their Roman law, English, and colonial ancestors? The answer is that they tried to develop a document that reproduced the best features of the English Constitution without the features they had found abusive in 1776. They wrote a constitution that had a stronger executive than did the Articles of Confederation, but not as strong an executive as King George III or Lord North. They wrote a constitution that created a more powerful national government than did the Articles of Confederation, but not as powerful a national government as that they had suffered under as lackeys in the British Empire. They produced a constitution with a Bill of Rights to protect liberty and property from democratic legislatures because they had discovered that democratic legislatures could threaten rule of law values just as much as English kings could. In sum, our rule of law securing constitution of 1787 gestated over an 11-year period of time from 1776 to 1787 and emerged as a kind of compromise between the English colonial regime and the decentralized regime of the Articles of Confederation. The critical balance between order and freedom, which was struck in our constitution, was driven, if you will, by two nightmares which have haunted Americans ever since. The first nightmare associated with 1776 is the nightmare of the distant imperial tyranny with an all-powerful executive. The second nightmare associated with 1787 is the nightmare of the local or village tyrant and of the all-powerful rights-invading democratic legislature. Our Constitution of 1787 sought to secure and promote the rule of law by protecting against both the nightmare of 1776 and the nightmare of 1787. That the framers succeeded so brilliantly suggests that the 11-year gestation period of our Constitution may have been critical to its striking the right balance between order and freedom.
I hope this exegesis makes it clear why it is so hard to export our system of constitutionalism and of respect for the rule of law into Russia or Afghanistan or Iraq or any other emerging new democracy. The particular and highly unique constellation of events that gave rise to the U.S. Constitution and to our tradition of respect for the rule of law happened spontaneously as the result of many fortuitous and combined historical forces. One cannot give rise to such a tradition just by imposing a document or an ideal from above. It has to spring spontaneously from the desires and lived experience of millions of people. We can and should be an example and an inspiration to newly emerging democracies everywhere, and sometimes the best one can start with is an imposed constitution of the kind we wrote for Japan and West Germany after World War II. There's always the hope that that imposed constitution will grow and take root, albeit in distinctively native ways, in alien soil. But the process of creating a respect for the rule of law where it has long been absent is a daunting one, and somehow we must find a way by example to spread our respect for the rule of law to cultures where law has not yet been separate from or supreme over religious edicts or over the orders of high government officials. Thank you.